So imagine you've been at a wedding where they've been out and bought a good amount of a relatively decent wine, something we might call in the England a decent plonk. Not bad, an easy drinker. For those among us who are abstainers, please indulge me for a moment with this image. Imagine you've got anything you especially enjoy drinking. For me, I personally love a mocktail made of Silk Road Philosopher's Brew with tonic water, but that's a conversation for another time, probably. So the beverages are going down smoothly, and then you realize the waiting staff are packing up the glasses. It seems to have run out. Not that you're worried, because you're feeling a little bit happy. Not drunk exactly, but you consumed maybe a little more than expected. What with the speeches going on so long and that strange uncle that was convinced about the existence of chemtrails. But then you see a whole new batch of glasses being filled and put out on a side table. And you're handed one by a friendly waiter and you taste it and it's fantastic. It's the best you've ever tasted. There's a richness about it, a body, a flavor that just seems to ignite your senses. And you can't help but go straight to that happy couple and congratulate them on the astounding quality of their wine choice, although they seem a little bit bemused by all of it. Imagine. That's something of how it may have been in the story for this evening. As a story, it offers the opportunity for great imaginative leaps. And a description of an event, it may ring true for many of us. This is the kind of thing we understand. Good wine, a party, friends, family, a celebration. And that's what the author or authors of John's Gospel want us to imagine. They want us to have the feeling of the story. The scriptures are full of theological and spiritual meanings, but above all, they're full of stories for us to engage with and enter into. These stories are shared that they may inform our own story of faith. And they invite us to tell our own story and our own feelings about faith to one another and to others beyond our community. These stories do not have to be literal to be true. What is key is that they help us to feel the truth and experience the truth of the divine life, which all of our scripture stories point towards. Chances are, this is not a record of an actual historical event. It's a story that's meant to impart a meaning beyond just being a literal account of this happened. John's Gospel, from which this story comes, is the most carefully constructed Gospel of all the four Gospels that we have, and contains material, including this, not found in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, which we call the Synoptic Gospels. In the Gospel of John, because it was written perhaps 30 or 40 years after the other Gospels, and that means something like 70 years after Jesus, we have an account of the life and the ministry, the death and the resurrection of Jesus that is very thoughtfully put together. Nothing is there by chance. Everything is so carefully considered as to make each passage, each story more than is immediately apparent and worth careful and repeated reading. For instance, throughout the Bible, the number 6 is seen as the number of imperfection. God created in 6 days, but the creation was hallowed and blessed by God's rest on the seventh. The number of the beast, so beloved of horror film writers, is 666, representing a multiplication of imperfection, many will say. So maybe, and this is by no means the only possible interpretation, the authors are telling us that there are 6 jars to represent something missing that's only made complete by the presence of the Christ at the feast, the seventh. Next, why 100 liters? Well, I don't think it is 100 liters in the original, but it is in the translation that we have. Well, that's a lot of wine. Someone calculated it's something like 1,500 bottles of wine at our current standards. And as with the later account of, and there's probably not 1,500 guests at the wedding, and even if there was a bottle each at this point, would have been quite a party. But as with the later account of the feeding of the 5,000 or 4,000, depending which one we read, there is a sense of God's abundance being present in this place. God's grace being poured out, to echo the first chapter of John's Gospel, through Christ. Surely one jar would have been enough, we might say. Well, that's not the case, the writer says, in God's way of doing things. And thirdly, why mention that these jars were for Jewish purification rites? Surely most Jews would have known that, and Gentiles possibly didn't need to know. Perhaps also the writer is trying to say something about Jesus being deeply rooted in his culture and the recognition of the traditions of Jewish rabbinic stylings. And these are all possible, but by no means definitive or even necessarily accurate, because there are so many different ways you can look at it, ways of looking at this story. And they point us towards stories that are meant to give us some link to the greater Jesus story, a story of faith and of hope and of love. More than anything, we are reminded that these are stories to fire our imaginations and our hearts, to gain glimpses of the abundant, life-giving grace of the divine, but not stories we're called to take literally. A story like this reminds us that the reign of God is one of transformation, of life, of joy, of peace, of love, and of celebration, and seeks to inspire those of us who live within and share that sense of abundant, hopeful grace which these stories point towards. So we too have stories to listen, to learn from, and to share in our life together and our life in this world which God has given us to tell the story of and to. Thanks be to God.